Good morning, everybody. Sorry, good afternoon already, everybody. So as where I'm back, just got back from Australia, so I'm not sure where the hell I am. But welcome anyway. And as you can see, I'm standing in for the indomitable Nick Lorimer, who has been laid low by the lurgies that I think seem to be affecting much of the midwinter audience. So I hope you are all well out there. And on the show with me today is Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, welcome. And Herman Pretorius.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you. And just as you were speaking, I felt the first hints of an esophageal irritation that might turn into a cough. Damn it.
let's move that cough into the next stage. And we obviously have to look at all hail the chief, Donald Trump, the next president of the United States. Herman? Am I right? You know, there's nothing like almost being killed to really up you in the ratings.
Yeah, no. If you look at it from a sort of campaign's perspective, generally you can boil down the purpose of a political campaign to two things. You want to drip feed a message. So you want to be really consistent in making sure that your message reaches the audience as regularly as possible and as unobtrusively as possible. It must become part of their framework of acceptance. And then the other part is to create moments. You want to get the likelihood in your favor that there will be a defining moment that will, you know, shift the narrative in your favor. In terms of moments, in terms of defining moments, you can hardly do better than this, especially within the narrative that Trump was trying to drip feed. His message has been, they're out to get me, and they're out to get me because I'm on your side. And that manifested in sort of the lie about the 2020 election result, the court cases. And to be fair to Trump, the establishment did behave quite silly at some point during his presidency. So the frustration for folks like me is that the deep state might not be as sophisticated and as Klaus Schwab dominated as people might think in the darker corners of the internet, but the establishment did just enough to give credence to the narrative that they're out to get him. So nothing says quite they're out to get me like being shot at. So in terms of his narrative, he now has that in the blood, as it were. That narrative is there. They're out to get Trump. He was right all along. All the court cases, all the collusion, it's all been about getting Trump. And the reason they wanted to get him is because he's for middle America. He wants to make America great again. So that narrative is gone. In terms of catching up with that, it's a mile ahead. The Democrats, it will be tough for them to catch up. And then the other thing about creating a moment. I said to my wife yesterday, I think this is the most important political moment in America since 9/11, in terms of dominating and defining what the politics of the day will be like. And that feeds into the second part of Trump's narrative, is that America is fundamentally broken and he's the guy to fix it. He's the guy who won't be, you know, gotten down by those who want to get him. And I mean, you couldn't have scripted it better.
Terence, there are a number of things that arise out of this, and this is the fact that it comes on the heels of that the presidential debate that didn't more than met what people expected of it in the negative sense, but also the fact that, you know, he's this conviction for paying off, I suppose, what's another term for Stormy Daniels, the sex worker, for not revealing their relationship. And being
adult assumed, actress.
Sorry?
The sorry. Adult actress, I would go with.
Adult actress. Oh, sorry. I
I'm the one person to admit that I knew who she was long before this became a thing.
The less we said about that, the better. He's just come out of that, and the general sense, certainly from his supporters' point of view, that lawfare is what is being used, is what has been used by the Democrats to sully his opportunity. But that almost seems to recede because as Herman says, there's nothing quite like being shot at, and it's not unfamiliar American political experience to have assassinations, or at least attempt assassinations, as one way of dealing with the issues. And this, somebody said that the Democrats and the Republicans should probably create two separate countries to live in. There's so little to govern. There's so little in common. There's just no one's talking to each other anymore, and hasn't for a long time. You're feeling on Texas.
Well, look, I forced myself to watch that whole debate, and I'm also the only South African who's not a bona fide expert in American politics, so just put that out there. It just seems to me that if this is what the world's first hyperpower can produce, then there is a serious problem. I said, you know, someone who's, you know, 30 years younger and not insane, you should be able to walk it. Unfortunately, I think we have age and insanity going on there, and just temperamental unfitness. But yeah, Herman's quite correct. Narrative, narrative, narrative. You know, the other thing is that four American presidents have been assassinated. Now, America isn't the only country where this sort of thing happens. But, you know, there is something about the way it was done, you know, there's something about being shot at by a sniper as opposed to someone pushing a Saturday night special into your stomach and shooting. The latter seems more like a crime of passion, but there's something, you know, darkly professional about a sniper. And I think that's why President Kennedy's assassination has been the stuff of such legend, has contributed to the Kennedy mystique. And now it seems that you know, another Kennedy maybe trying to get himself on the ballot, which could be interesting. I'm also reminded of the Manchurian Candidate, where the protagonist is shot towards the end, and then, you know, the idea is for this world-changing speech to be made over his body, and Trump, you know, although I'm not suggesting there's a Manchurian Candidate type thing going on here, but give it to him. He understood the political theater of the moment. You know, fight, fight, fight. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, as things stand, this probably takes him over the line, for better or worse. As I say, my own sense on the basis of what I know, and I'm not an American, so I don't get to vote there, and it's, you know, in a sense, I'm very much a bystander. Just seems to me, if this is the best the American Republican can offer at present, this does not bode well for that whole geopolitical space. And yeah, you know, like it or not, America is the guarantor of the world order as it exists, as the British Empire was before, and, you know, in various times, Rome, the Ottoman Empire, you know, whatever have done. I don't know. I think that there's something profoundly destabilizing about all of that.
Herman, just on the sort of the destabilization and the comment in the chat about how corrupt Pennsylvania is, where the shooting occurred, Bethel Park in a suburb of Pittsburgh. But a huge amount of discussion, I imagine, investigation should be underway about exactly how the police and the security establishment dealt with that shooting, and because he seemed to get relatively close in the circumstances, given the fact that it was a sniper shooting, and people saw the man on the roof, or people said they saw the man on the roof, and sort of pointed it out, and the police kind of didn't respond. Is one being too critical of it? Because obviously the people around him probably looked like they knew what they were doing, but that does raise questions. I mean, 100 odd meters, 200 meters, not a lot of distance for a sniper in the circumstances.
Yeah, and look, the Secret Service dropped the ball here. I'm not a security expert, but it just strikes me as quite bizarre that you would have a former president, a presidential candidate, a likely president, giving a speech. And as far as I could see, there are limited options from which height could be achieved down onto where the event was taking place. And one would expect that those are the first points of vulnerability that the Secret Service would scope out, would secure, and would make sure that those obvious angles of attack in a country with this history of political assassinations and attempted assassinations, that would be difficult to carry out. So that's the first question, is the Secret Service will have some questions to answer in terms of how it failed to secure the perimeter properly. I mean, this is a lesson that should have been learnt in Dallas 1963 on the 22nd of November, that you make sure the high ground from where your protection subject will be visible is secured. Then number two.
Sorry, sir?
Yes, the grassy knoll. And I mean, then the second problem that I think the state has, as it were, in terms of the security forces, is the FBI came out quite soon and said this was an attempted assassination, which I think is revealing something of a political pressure, because Trump's relationship with the FBI wasn't great when he was in office. James Comey, then chief of the Bureau, accused Trump of wanting to interfere in their independence. Trump had a problem with the FBI being disloyal and being part of the deep state. So that the FBI came out and didn't, you know, pull a UN Rwanda type of, let's take 20 years to decide whether it was genocide or not. The fact that they came out very soon, very early on, called it an attempted assassination, it says to me that the FBI feels that they understood that there is going to be political pressure. If they are now, like some of them, like some journalists have done in the immediate hours after the aftermath, you know, Trump rushed off stage in chaotic scenes, or Trump collapses on stage. Some of the headlines that you saw in the newspapers, the FBI understood that, my goodness, if they prevaricate now, then their credibility is going to take a blow with at least a third of the country, and probably two thirds if you add the independents in there, who all very quickly came to the conclusion, as most people would have, okay, this was obviously an attempted assassination attempt. And then the third security component here that's problematic is the local police. And it's one of those typical, you know, gimmicks or cliches, not even cliches, tropes, that's the word, trope of a police procedural, is the hustle and the tassel and the bustle over jurisdiction. Whose responsibility was it ultimately to secure that field? Was it the local police? Was it Trump's security detail? Was it, you know, and the problem that now comes from whatever happens is, if heads will roll, it won't be enough, but it will also be too much. For the extremes, it won't be enough, and for the other extreme, it will be too much. Then there's the problem of how this investigation will work and what will be a satisfying conclusion that people will actually believe. And that's the danger with the escalating rhetoric that I think we've seen over the last 15 years in America, that the distrust in the system has gotten so deep that the common ground, Tara, as you said about the two countries, the two Americas, I think it took about 100 years to get here, and I think it might take a similar amount of time to recover, because to my mind, it goes back to the isolation and the insularity of the federal government. And I think in a very nerdish way, that was made possible by the 17th Amendment, because before the 17th Amendment, the Senate represented the interests of the state legislatures. Alabama, California, and so on could nominate the two senators. They would represent the federal states, or they would represent the states and in the federal Congress, in the Capitol. And then the 17th Amendment made senators directly electable by the population of those states. And that removed the idea of the states having the say in Washington. And I think that's where the insularity on both sides came about, is the distance grew over 100 years. And I don't see how you recover that within a short amount of time. And my goodness, if there's a political landscape that didn't need heat added to it, it was the American one.
Terence, can I just go back to you on one question? I mean, my impression very quickly from the reports that the shooter was more likely to be a sort of larger even or the same version as the school shooters that one has come to associate it with America. And by all accounts, that seems to be what it was. It wasn't a sort of sinister group behind it, although I'm sure the conspiracy theories go that way. What's your impression of what the shooter appeared to have been? Who he appeared to have
been? Okay, on the basis of the very, very limited information I have, he seems to have been somebody who wanted some form of notoriety, or perhaps had a personal axe to grind. Perhaps it was political, but it doesn't appear to have been part of a network. But that's often profoundly unsatisfying. You know, that's why Lee Harvey Oswald, we got JFK making those movies. Oswald's brother, incidentally, said he had no doubt that he carried out and he acted alone. Just said that's the kind of person he was. So take that for whatever you want. Look, in terms of actually getting that close, I was quite correct. There'll be many questions to answer, but also going back to the 60s, apparently the French were stunned at how loosely protected Kennedy was. The French do security very well because there've been attempts on de Gaulle. And I remember that when Barack Obama came to speak at Mandela's funeral, there was a bogus interpreter So yeah, my sense is that if this guy was a professional, it would have probably been a two-man team from a vantage point where they couldn't be gunned down, and it would probably have been two shots, one on top of another, and they would have been out to a non-extradition country, because I've also watched JFK.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, now we're going to go from the extraordinary to the core blimey, as my grandmother used to say. And we're looking at a document that's been put out by the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation, which is entitled Planning for the Seventh Administration, that's this new government, towards the development of the medium-term development plan 2024-2029. Now, it's a discussion document, and it basically refers to the National Development Plan, which goes now back to 2012 as a foundation for the next 5 years, the sort of dealing with reduction of poverty, inequality, and unemployment, creating inclusive growth in Africa, and meeting international commitments vis-a-vis poverty, protecting the planet, and prosperity for all. Now, I'm not in a position to sort of dig down deep on this, but the impression we've got to the what used to be the medium-term strategic framework, which would be put out to assess and to attempt to be an aid in reaching the goals for 2030, is now being renamed, I suppose, because we've got a GNU, as the medium-term development plan. And there seems to be two immediate impressions from it. The one is that it's almost like, well, now we're really going to take economic growth and prioritize the state of the economy and growth. And the other is that the GNU statement of intent will be very much the basis of the discussions and how this plan will pan out. Terence, what sort of struck you about what you've seen so far? And as I said, still open for discussion.
Yeah, look, to an extent, more of the same. I do think it's interesting when it says the emphasis on an economic growth-led plan, which will prioritize economic interventions across clusters. Resources must be directed toward productive investment while maintaining the social wage. Yeah, that's something that I can sort of get behind, the idea that you need to expand the economy, and that the welfare system that we have actually needs an economy to support it. I think it's a very broad brushstrokes thing. I mean, when they talk about health, the national health insurance, for instance, appears there. So some of these highly contentious things, what they've done, I think, is they've transposed what existed beforehand and said, well, this is our starting point. But what is interesting is that if you go towards the back, you'll see that there are tables which list the promises from the nine or whatever, however many parties are signed up to this thing. That is quite jarring in a way. There have been government documents that have explicitly referred to ANC conference resolutions and ANC manifesto promises and the Freedom Charter. In other words, very much within the party state dynamic. And now what we seem to be heading into is a reluctant bureaucratic acceptance that it is the party's state. That I think it's the cock and the weather vane, but it does show some sort of movement.
Herman, you're feeling, since there seems to be some degree of acceptance that the show is not entirely the ANC's at this point, and the fact that we actually do need an economy for all sorts of reasons, including the provision of services to those who desperately need them. Might this be, let's say, that little sense of shift, or God, dare I say, a sense of sort of shared humility? No, okay, you know what I mean.
Yeah, we daren't say it. It's possibly. Is that good enough? So the problem thus far is it's both positive and negative that the developments up to this point have skirted around the edges a bit. What frustrates me in the two or three significant steps that have been taken to institutionalize the GNU, and if we the strategic intent framework, the cabinet, and this document, what they seem to lack across the board is a proper diagnosis of what's gone wrong. They have good words, that would appeal to anyone on the center left to the center right, in terms of noble goals. But that's not the problem. South Africa's government has never really lacked the nobility of goals in terms of its rhetoric. The NDP, for what it's worth, having collected dust for a few years now, is a fine, laudable centrist document that I wouldn't have a problem with seeing implemented. It's not the sort of classic liberal approach I would ideally take, but we're realistic about what could be achieved. The strategic development goals of, on which the DA based some of their policy ambitions, that's fine. It's again centrist good old stuff that people could find common ground on. But that hasn't been the problem in South Africa. And I don't think that's the problem in any of the three. I don't think that's the substance in any of the three steps taken to this point. Is in no point was there, I think, serious diagnostic work done about, we've got these noble goals that are fine. Why haven't we accomplished them? Why haven't we achieved them? And we've heard from, state of the nation addresses and budgets and so on. The ANC has been good at blame shifting. I mean, they have relied on true enough excuses to hide at least some of their failures for their own blushes. But the fact of the matter is that serious failures got us here, and that only an honesty about those failures, about what caused them, about what exacerbated them, is what's going to get us out. So the middle ground, good old stuffy stuffs that we see here about inclusive economic growth, yeah, fine. That's not what's been lacking. What's been lacking is a form of being empirical about policy, seeing what works, allowing decentralization so that people at various levels of government can experiment with various policies. And I think that's one of the strongest arguments for a decentralized system. Is in America, you can have Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, and Missouri all try to solve the healthcare problem and do it in the way that they best see fit. And that allows over time the federal government to go, that worked, that didn't work, and sort of build a national consensus from there. We don't have that. I think the diagnostic tools and the diagnostic attitude is the real disappointment here.
Terence, does this offer the other parties in the GNU the opportunity to potentially ties the ANC into something other than, well, what we really hope to do is implement ANC policy, and we'll find ways of doing it. And this is intended to cover our evil intent over this period. Actually treating the statement of intent as a signed document of agreement and not a plaything for negotiations.
Well, look, I think of this that's sort of how it's intended, or at least that's how the other parties will conceive it, that they want to that they'll want to use it as a basis for negotiation, and they hope they can shift the needle. I think the ANC probably wants to continue as normal. I think we're almost at this sort of we're having talks about talks. This is really at the I think Herman mentioned used a phrase like that earlier. I think that's accurate. And I think before you can actually start to come up with solutions, you're going to have to build some sort of trust. So. And mutual confidence. So look, this is a tough uphill battle. My sense is that a lot of this stuff is just too ideologically dear for the ANC to negotiate away from it. But you know, maybe we could at least postpone some of the fatal ideological decisions. So you know, rather than talking about NHI whether it's good or bad, we can talk about why don't we try and sort out the condition of public hospitals? Then, you know, in a couple of years' time, maybe, you know, sentiment around NHI has shifted. Maybe they actually trust each other more to sort of to listen to alternatives. This is, you know, to channel my inner Jordan Peterson, as I do on occasion. This is difficult stuff, man.
So essentially what we're saying is you can call it NHI, you can call it what you like, as long as we fix the hospitals and replace the management.
I say we're not even discussing NHI, you know, exactly. At the moment, because I think, you know, it's like I say, you know, do you sort of book a hotel room with a lady that you haven't sent a WhatsApp to yet? You know, you've got to start small. No, I don't want to hear it.
Well, let's look at a lady who should be an inspiration to us all, and that is the very famous Dr. Ruth, who, even if one didn't hear her speak and give advice, one probably heard of. She died at the age of 96, and that wasn't the most astonishing thing about her. She was essentially the first media sex therapist, radio and television, and she started that career in, I think, the age of 52. So she'd already led a life before that. But other than writing guides like Sex for Dummies and becoming essentially a pop culture icon, it turned out that she had a really, really fascinating past. And the idea of being a sniper in the pre-Israel state underground military movement, the Haganah, all 4'7" of her, before she went on to study, I suppose, sex and sociology and psychology. Terence, where are these? They don't make women like this anymore.
I'm not sure, you know, it depends where you're looking. But let me say, as a sort of 80s, as an 80s kid, I've never actually listened to or watched a Dr. Ruth show, but she was like a meme. Everyone knew who Dr. Ruth was. I think in a way she kind of revolutionized the whole, revolutionized sex and took it out of the bedroom and into the living room. She made it mainstream. And I suppose that's why today I can declare that I knew who Stormy Daniels was on the Daily Friend show, because, you know, that's, you know, and, you know, for those interested in Pittsburgh, I'm just going to say the name Paige Owens. And I'm sure many of our people are going to go off and Google that instantly. Point is, you know, she brought a lot of taboos out, put them put them before the world. And yeah, there's enormous backstory. Sent to Switzerland by her parents before they perished in the Nazi death camps. Lived fought in Israel's independence war. Studied in France. Married, I think, four times. You know, she packed a lot of life into her 92 years.
And she ended up with a doctorate in sociology, I think it was, from Columbia. And it's perhaps not only she got highly qualified, but because of that past and because of that unspeakable history that she had to deal with, and immigrating to Palestine when it was, Israel wasn't yet a thing, and she was 16 years old. She was, what made her, I think, particularly impressive was that her show ended up moving from the midnight slot to daytime. First ever discussions on sex on daytime television. But her she avoided no issue. She was frank in her responses. She interestingly also gave a thumbs up to the role that sex plays in Orthodox Jewish marriages. The thought is, and it's that sort of, I suppose it's that element that more than anything, America, just talking generally about the theme of America, what America's good at was you could create a niche based on the fact that America's always ready to set a whole new set of boundaries or expand boundaries in a way that the old European West, perhaps not so much, Herman.
Well, I think if I'm going to come clean here, I'm not an expert on Dr. Ruth, but two things struck me as you guys were talking about, and I looked at her career from a very, very cramming sort of perspective, is number one, challenging paradigmatic orthodoxies is not always comfortable, but people who do it are fewer today than I think there should be. If you could challenge the puritanical attitudes of sex in the 20th century, then we should have the same guts and power to challenge the prevailing thought now. And America used to be able to take that, and academic circles and universities used to be able to take that on the chin and accept that we're going to encourage the challenging of held ideas like people like Dr. Ruth did. We're seeing less of that than we should, and that's worrying. And another thing that I think is fascinating about her isn't necessarily that she was Jewish, but that she comes in as part of a 150-year period of emerging Jewish excellence in various fields, from the sciences to the humanities, across the board. That wasn't always the case. I'm relying heavily on Thomas Sowell's, race and disparities work. For much of history, Jewish people weren't the leading figures that they would become in the 20th century in various fields. And it's not because the Jews changed. It is because circumstances allowed them to flourish. And I think if you look at an icon like Dr. Ruth, there is a question to be asked about what circumstances allowed her to flourish, what freedoms allowed her to become the, groundbreaking figure that she was. And I think at every point you will see it was non-racialism, it was tolerance, it was free speech, it was the good old liberal values of freedom that we so easily take for granted sometimes.
And if I can just close by surmising that one of the reasons she could become another reason she became an icon is that she's born and brought up in Germany, so she sounded like a female 4'7" Jewish grandmother, aka Sigmund Freud, and that might have been what crossed the line for her. But on that,
The Freudian slip is when you want to say one thing, but you say your mother. I mean, another.
She sounded like my grandmother. What can I say? Well, She will be missed because they, as I say, I just don't think they make her anymore, but we will be back to talk about the things that make us and make us repeatedly frustrated and hopeful perhaps, but who knows? I'll leave that for the next host to deal with. Thank you and see you tomorrow.
Bye-bye.